It is great to have you all here at our Wednesday night service. If you're new to this service with us, we want to welcome you. It is different than what we do on Sunday. Sunday morning is much more polished. It's more of a sermon, 3 points, 5 points, whatever it is. Tonight is different. Tonight we open our Bibles. We read through them a line at a time, a verse at a time, a chapter at a time. We go through a book from the beginning to the end. And we just go until the time runs out, usually about an hour, and then we will pick up where we left off next week. And so the goal is usually to do a chapter an evening. Tonight we might be able to do a couple of chapters, but we are picking up where we left off last week, and that is in the book of Joshua, chapter 15. So we're in Joshua 15, and we've been looking at this incredible chronicle of this faithful man of the Lord. He was second in charge of all of Israel while Moses was leading. He led in that capacity. He served in that capacity for 40 years until Moses dies. God elevates Joshua to the position of leader of all of Israel at 75 years old. He leads Israel in the invasion of the land of Canaan. They go and they fight for another 5 years. Where we pick up, they have already conquered the land, and now they're starting to divide it up among the different tribes. And so that kind of brings us from the beginning to where we are, which is Joshua chapter 15. Just a couple of quick things to share with you. First of all, we have a number of things happening in the church over the fall. So I do want to encourage everybody, if you don't normally do it, make a habit of reading through the bulletin on Sunday morning. We put a lot of stuff in there. We have recently started adding to that an outline of the message. And so you're going to get all the sermon notes that I have. You're going to get those kind of in a concise version, but all the notes that I'm using. There's questions at the bottom. It's intended that you would answer those for yourself and just kind of reflect on some of the things. And then even with small groups, sometimes what they'll do is take the message itself and use that as a topic of discussion that week. And the idea then behind this outline and these questions is just kind of equipping those groups as well to help, you know, foster that kind of conversation. So definitely want to encourage you to do that. Get in the habit of grabbing one of those bulletins. I would like, and you know, I say this, I would like to see our bulletins kind of come back in a real tangible way. We got away from printing them for a while. I think there's definitely some benefit to having something in your hand, something that you can actually read and reference. And I don't know if it's because I get older and I get more annoyed with all the technology and everything's on a screen now that I just want an actual book. But kind of getting to the point where so many things have gone digital. There's going to be a solar flare one day, and you know, what are we going to do? So we have the bulletins. We're trying to kind of build those back up, make those more of a tool for Sunday. And so those will be there for you on Sunday morning. So I do want to encourage you, grab those and just let us know how that goes. Give us some feedback. In the seat backs, you have yellow cards. Those are prayer cards. Those are available Wednesday night. Our Agape boxes are here. And if you have anything that you'd like us to pray for, please let us know that. And then if there's anything the Lord has laid on your heart to give this evening, and I want to stress, this is over and above. This is not in place of, this is not instead of your normal tithe. We're not trying to ask people to, you know, give twice or anything. But if the Lord has laid on your heart to give something, anything we have received on Wednesday night, historically we have dedicated to our radio ministry. And we've been on the radio, 107.5 Alive FM. It's our local station. We're on there every Sunday evening at 6:30. What we do is we take our Sunday morning messages and we actually produce those into a 30-minute program that then gets aired all over the region. And we've been there, for maybe like 8-9 years now. We've been in that single time slot. And we've spoken with people who listen on the radio. They've come to the church here because of the radio. They've written to us. They've sent postcards and newsletters and emails and phone calls and all kinds of things. They've reached out to us just telling us it's been a blessing to them to be able to tune into a local church that does this kind of teaching, because it's not common for many churches to do the kind of things that we do. And so they've given us feedback that it certainly has helped. So we continue that ministry. But it isn't free. It does cost us about $100 a week to be there. And so we said when we started this service that anything that was given on Wednesday night would go directly to our Light the Way ministry, which is that radio program. And so just so you know what happens to that on Wednesday night, that's what we do. But for this evening, we are in Joshua chapter 15. And let's pray. Lord, we're here tonight because we believe that there is benefit to putting life on pause, to hitting that pause button, to slowing down, to putting work aside, putting the bills aside, the chores aside, putting the schedule and the busyness aside, and taking this minute to top off the cup. Because Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday can be hard. And we get to the end of Wednesday, and Lord, sometimes it's hard to realize we've got two more days to go before the weekend. And so we come because we need to be refreshed, and we need to be filled, we need to be built, we need to be taught, and we turn to your word. This is the bread of life. Jesus said that we don't live by bread alone in a physical sense, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And so, Lord, as we turn to your bread, your manna, this meal that you have for us, I pray that you would give us ears to hear it, minds to understand it, and hearts to receive and apply and live. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, as I said, we're in Joshua 15, and we have watched as Israel has crossed the Jordan River. They've gone from battle to battle, from victory to victory. They conquered the city of Jericho, where they marched around it, and the walls fell. And you remember that because it was the worst military strategy anybody could ever imagine. They lined all of their soldiers up. They made a lot of noise. They did it during the day. Nobody was able to fight back. And they were basically a big, open, broadside target of the inhabitants of Jericho as they marched around the city every single day. For a week they did this. And finally they marched around for seven times. And then the whole city wall fell down. And so they won the battle. But it was in such a way that they should not have won the battle. If you put that in a military academy and you tried to teach future officers of the Army or the Marine Corps or whoever it is a strategy, that would exactly not be what you told them. You would never say, hey, make your flank exposed. Put all of your men out there defenseless and give the enemy target after target, day after day after day. There's just no reason any military strategist would do that. They would never go into battle that way. And yet that's exactly what God commanded Israel to do. And it was because when they won the battle, it would be clear that it wasn't their strategy. It wasn't their wits. It wasn't their capabilities, but rather all because of God's grace. And so they go from Jericho to a number of other battles. They go to the city of Ai. They go to all over the land. In fact, in the end, they conquer some 39 different cities. And so they have conquered the land of Canaan. They first went and divided the nation in half. They went south and conquered all of that territory, north and conquered all of that territory. And it tells us that there was actually not 39, but 31 cities, 31 kings in all, it says at the end of chapter 12. So a lot of battles, a lot of victory, a lot of God intervening. At times, Israel was outnumbered 5-1, 10-1. They never seemed to have the upper hand, and yet God never failed them. And so now all of that's done. The battles have been fought and won, and now they own the land. It's been given to them. The war is over, but they don't quite possess it yet. And we're going to read about the difference between owning something and possessing it in a very practical sense. But now Israel is going about the work of possessing it, and Joshua is there. Caleb is also there. And you remember Joshua and Caleb. They were the only two faithful spies from when Moses, 45 years before, had sent 12 spies into the land of Canaan to scout it out. They came back. Two of them said, we can take it. That was Joshua and Caleb. They said, look, God's already given us this land. This is for us. Even though Joshua was not a native Israelite, he was a proselyte, he was a convert, he was an immigrant who came in and became Israelite, he had more faith in the God of Israel than most of Israel did, because the other 10 spies said, there's no way we can do it. There's giants in the land, there's fortified cities in the land, they've got walls around their cities, there's castles, there's big men of valor. We're going to go and get slaughtered. This is, you know, like the Boy Scouts trying to fight against the Marine Corps. You know, they're going up against the Navy SEALs. We're never going to win this fight. And that kind of fear is contagious. And we saw how that fear then spread through all of Israel, and they all doubted. And so God said, fine, you're not going to go in. For 40 years, you're going to wander this wilderness, and no one over the age of 20, 20 being the age of culpability at that time, no one over the age of 20 is going to be allowed into the promised land. It's going to be for your children and Joshua and Caleb, because they were the ones that said we can actually do it. Well, now they have entered that promised land. Again, 5 years of warfare. They've conquered 31 city-states. They've won the battles. They're dividing the land. And here they are giving out the allotments. So last week we started looking at that. The land divided west of the Jordan, and we talked about that, how the land divided east of the Jordan was 2.5 tribes, because they had the first 2.5 tribes of Reuben, Gadites, and half a tribe of Manasseh, who said, look, we don't want to cross the Jordan. We don't want to go fight. We're happy where we are. And so as Israel first approached the Jordan River, these tribe leaders went to Moses at the time and said, look, we don't want to go and do all of that. We're happy with this. Just give us our allotment now. And they settled on the eastern side of the River Jordan. Well, when Israel crossed into the promised land under Joshua, he went in with 9.5 tribes, because 2.5 of the 12 stayed behind. They conquered the land, and so now it's being divided. And so we saw Caleb inherits Hebron, and Caleb is really an interesting guy. We've spent most of the book looking at Joshua. And Joshua is a faithful servant. Joshua was second under Moses, as I said, for 40 years. Joshua never got jealous of that. Joshua never had this idea in his heart that he should be the guy that was in charge. He never resented Moses. He served, and he served faithfully and humbly. And the Lord saw that in him. And so when Moses died, Joshua was promoted. And then Joshua, in that same kind of humility, leads the nation into this promised land. Well, we've heard about his story and his victories and his triumphs, but now we're hearing about Caleb. Caleb was with Joshua during all of that time. Caleb is a guy who is also in his old age. In fact, it even began last week when we started looking at it, and it said that the Lord told Caleb that he was old. And it says in verse 13, and the Lord said to him, you are old and advanced in years. And so we started looking at how, even though Caleb is kind of on the sundown side of life, he's still looking for new challenges. And he wants to attack this mountain. He wants to get what God has promised him. And so it even says in chapter 14 and verse 10, here I am this day 85 years old. And even at 85 years old, he knew that God was still with him and he was ready for new challenges. He wasn't ready for retirement. He was ready for revival. He was ready for a new campaign. He was looking for how God was going to use him in this stage of life, not looking for a way that he could kind of wind down and just bide his time. And so we end chapter 14 as that very thing is happening. Joshua is in charge. Caleb goes to him and says, look, Joshua, I've been here a long time. I was promised this land. I've been faithful. I did everything I was asked. Yeah, I might be 85 right now, but I still want my mountain. I want Hebron. And so give me the mountain that the Lord spoke of that day and told me I could have. And so Joshua blesses him, because what else are you going to do with an 85-year-old guy that's just dead set on attacking this mountain and taking on the giants? You say, have at it, man. You know, better you than me. And so he sends him there, and he goes, and he fights Hebron. And it says that he won. He goes and defeats the enemy. And so now we come to chapter 15, and this is going to start with the land of Judah. And so it begins by saying, so this was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah according to their families. And we're going to stop right there. I love that in spite of all of this, Joshua, Caleb, all of these others, they're still serving. They're still finding ways to be involved, still finding ways to be active. And we looked at Josh, we looked at Caleb, now we're coming to the tribe of Judah. Judah is the fourth tribe in Israel. So they're kind of an unlikely inheritor of much of the blessing that they're going to get. But we know that it is Judah who will get the largest allotment of land, and we can read about that here. By the way, we're not going to read all of this. There's a lot of little towns that we're not going to find on a map. They don't exist anymore. These boundaries don't really exist anymore. In the back of your Bible, if you have maps there, it might show you a map of the way the land was divvied up among the tribes. It's a great thing to reference so you kind of know what we're talking about. But for the sake of the narrative here, I mean, not many of us are ever going to go to these areas. Most of them, as I said, don't exist. They're not on maps. We can't even pronounce half of them because we don't know how they were pronounced. But that being said, Judah, the fourth in line, is actually going to get the largest allotment of land. That's an interesting thing because Reuben was actually the largest, or the first tribe, I should say. And yet Reuben does not get the largest inheritance. Reuben is going to get a much smaller inheritance than Judah for a couple of reasons. You might remember that Reuben was unfaithful. And it was back in the book of Genesis, if you recall the story, but it was with Joseph that his brother Reuben had an incestuous affair with his father's wife. And so because of their unfaithfulness, because of all of that that happened then, because of the way that they were through all of this time, they're not going to get as much as Judah. Judah was also the first to fight. They charged into the fray. They didn't panic. They didn't run. They were the first to serve, the first to volunteer. And the Lord is going to bless that and reward that. So Judah will get not only the most land, as it begins here with the children of the tribe of Judah, but we also know that because of the way Judah was so faithful, in Genesis 49, they actually get blessed. And they receive this special blessing, almost a prophetic blessing, where it says that Judah will be the one that the brothers will praise. And kind of interesting, because the name Judah literally means praise. And so, again, prophetically, Judah is named praise, and it turns out that, yes, the brothers will kind of, in a sense, praise them because it is in Judah that the temple will be built. And so all of the Jews and all of the rabbis and all the Pharisees and all the Hebrews will flock to this temple. They're going to worship there in Judah. And so all the other tribes are going to be there in the land of Judah praising the Lord. And so Judah will get blessing upon blessing. They're going to get a larger allotment of land. They're going to be the ones the brothers will praise. And not just because they hold the temple, but there's another promise that is made. If you remember, David comes from the tribe of Judah. And God makes a promise to David later on, and he says to David, there will never be a king that sits on the throne of Israel that doesn't come from your family line. And so from the line of David, from the house of David, of the tribe of Judah, will come Jesus Christ. And so in so many ways, the prophecy is fulfilled. Judah means praise. The temple will be there. The Lord will come from there. They get the largest amount of land, the greatest blessing. And so it begins here with the children of Judah according to their families. And then it goes on to kind of describe all of that. It says, the border of Edom at the wilderness of Zin southward was the extreme boundary, or the extreme southern boundary. And their southern border began at the shore of the Salt Sea, or the Dead Sea, from the bay that faces outward. Then it went to the southern side of the ascent of Akrabim, passed along to Zin, ascended on the south side of Kadesh Barnea, passed along to Hezron, and went up to Adar, and went around to Karkah. From there, it passed toward Asmon, not Amazon, but Asmon, and went out to the brook of Egypt, and the border ended at the sea. This shall be your southern border. So right away, we see the inheritance kind of start to form. Again, look on a map. When you get a chance, you'll get to see where these boundaries are. Most of these towns don't exist. You're probably not going to find them there, although you might find them in a biblical atlas. But there is an interesting just kind of message in this, just a truth for life for us that we can apply to us in 2025, almost 2026, even though this was written some 4,000 or 6,000 years ago. There's still truth that reigns for us today, and that is this. It becomes vitally important for us, for one generation, to steward the things that we've been given to then pass on to the next generation. As we see here with Judah, they're going to be given this allotment of land. And so it becomes the next generation's job to kind of keep that faith going. Now, Judah went into battle. Judah was faithful through the campaign. Judah will get this land, but this land will become a blessing as an inheritance to their children and their children's children and so on and so forth. And so it becomes our responsibility as parents to then steward the things that we've been given and then instill that kind of attitude of stewardship into our children so that as they grow up, they care for these blessings that the Lord has given us and they will then continue that cycle onward. You know, it's been said before that tough times create strong people, that strong people create easy times, that easy times create weak people, that weak people create tough times, and the tough times create strong people. And it goes on and on and on like that. It seems that it is a cycle that we see. You grow up in a household that has a lot of poverty. Maybe the example of parents wasn't all that great. Maybe mom and dad were always fighting. Maybe dad wasn't there. Maybe you lived hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. And then those children say, you know, when I grow up, I want my children to do better than this. And the parents certainly want better for their children there in that moment. And the children grow up and they say, I want my children to grow up better than I did. And it's interesting how that can happen, how these challenges create a type of character that you're not going to get anywhere else. It's almost like it's a forge of life. As steel is put into the furnace, that fire burns away all the impurities until what you have is solid and strong and durable. And likewise, life can be that way. It is a sort of furnace. It's a forge of life, where the impurities are beaten away through challenge and trial and tribulation and war and battle and all the ways that we're tested and tempted in life. That then gives us the ability to create maybe an easier time for our children, but therein sometimes can be the trap. Because that easy time does not produce the same kind of fortitude that the hard times did. Somebody asked me one time, who is the most at risk in a Christian home? And I answered it this way. I said, the second generation believer. Because they grew up in the church. Mom and dad were saved out of the world. They know what life is like. Their kids are going to grow up in that. They're never really going to see it the same way that mom and dad did. And so they're at much greater risk of kind of falling away as they get older. I think that's why we have Proverbs 22 to remind us to train up a child in the way they should go. And when they're old, they won't depart from it. They might take a while to circle back around. They might go prodigal. That arc might be kind of wide. But it's amazing how those values that we instill in our children will still be there. And they will steward the very things that God has entrusted them with. And then they'll raise their children in the same way. And so that's kind of the message here. Judah is going to receive this allotment, and this isn't going to be free. They've worked for it. They fought for it. They followed the Lord for it. They were faithful for it, but it's something they're just going to hand off to their children. The children didn't fight for it. The children don't have to deal with the Canaanites the same way. The children didn't have to go and march around the city of Jericho. They didn't have to go lose at the Battle of Ai, only to return again and win the next time around. The children didn't go through that. They didn't wander through the wilderness with their parents. The children didn't have to camp in the field and charge the enemy and face the steel of battle. But the kids are going to grow up with peace, and they're going to grow up with this inheritance. And so the warning for us and the encouragement and the instruction for us is that as we provide that for our kids, that we would encourage them and teach them to be stewards as well. And so here we see, this shall be your southern border. Verse 5, the east border was the Salt Sea as far as the mouth of the Jordan. And so the Dead Sea all the way to the east. And understand, when we talk about directions, Israel came into the promised land from the eastern side of the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan being everything basically between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean, that being the area that they conquered. Now, you look on a map right now, and it's a little backwards these days because you see that Israel is kind of in this little strip of land, and to the direct east of them is Palestine and all of these other nations. But in biblical days, all of that was Canaan, and Israel actually came from the opposite side of the River Jordan, crossed over, marching toward the Mediterranean Sea, dividing the nation in half, going south, then marching north, and now divvying up the land. And so the sea, the Salt Sea, the Dead Sea, the River Jordan, the Sea of Galilee is all going to be referred to as their easternmost border. And the border on the northern quarter began at the bay of the sea of the mouth of the Jordan. The border went up to Beth Hogla and passed north of Beth Arabah. And the border went up to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. The border went up toward Debir from the valley of Achor, and it turned northward toward Gilgal, which is before the ascent of Admumim, which is on the south side of the valley. The border continued toward the waters of En-Shemesh and ended at En-Rogel. And so we're introduced to this place, the Valley of Achor. The Valley of Achor is actually named after a guy named Achan in chapter 7. You might remember Achan because Achan was Achan. The word Achan means trouble, and Achan had trouble in his life. And it's interesting because where Achan is, he's buried, and he's buried there in the Valley of Achor. And it's interesting because later in the book of Hosea chapter 2, it's going to say that God says, bring Israel out of the wilderness and give them the Valley of Achor, which is the door of hope. And I love the message in that, that God is able to take this valley of hopelessness and turn it into an area of hope. And I think he does that with our life. He does that with everything that he touches. He takes what's broken, he takes what's lifeless, he takes the hopeless, and he breathes newness into it. He fixes and restores and rejuvenates and brings hope to the hopeless. And I love that because I've experienced it in my life. I'm sure you have as well at times where there's something that's happened and you think, you know, this is going to do me in. Whatever it is, this is the end of the line. I'm never getting out of this one. It can't get any worse. The business will never recover. The marriage will never recover. I'll never recover from the illness. You know, the money will never come in. I'm never going to get another job. I'll never save this job. The relationship is broken forever. Well, whatever it could be, you get to this valley of Achan, this hopeless position. And at a certain point, I think we all have realized all we can do is surrender it to the Lord. Lord, I can't do anything more with it. I can't fix it. I don't have enough money. I'm not smart enough. I don't have the right drugs. I don't have the medicine. The doctors don't know enough. Too far behind in the mortgage. The bank's foreclosing on Friday. Whatever the story might be. You know, I'm told from the other person they don't want to reconcile. There's nothing I can do to fix this. All I can do, Lord, I just give it to you. That's all I can do. It's broken beyond my repair, and so I'm going to give it to you because that's all that's left. And how many times have we seen God take the broken and put it back together again? In fact, I've experienced times where God has used the very thing that was broken as a sort of fulcrum point to then move the lever of life to turn hopelessness into hope. To use the very thing that you thought was going to do you in as soon as you surrender it to him to catapult you forward. I remember when I was working for a window and door company, And I don't want to say the name because we put this out on the internet, and so either way, I was working for a national brand window and door company. And they had told me that I wasn't going to lose my job, but layoffs were happening. A week later, I was laid off, and I went home. I remember I was really scared. I didn't know what to do. We had just had Owen. Melissa was now pregnant with Sierra, and so we're going, boy, what are we going to do? And so I go home. I tell her I just lost my job. She's on her way to work, but I remember praying with her there in our driveway, saying, I don't know what God's plan is, but I know the promise he made me was as long as I taught his word faithfully, he'd take care of us. And so I don't know what the plan is here, but he's got to be making room for something else because losing this job wasn't in my plans at all, and so he must have something in mind. So we gave it to the Lord. I went into my workshop. I started making furniture, started selling that, and did that for a while. I took a very, very temporary kind of job at a factory a little while later as a carpenter. But then it was interesting because the Lord opened up a door of opportunity for us to sell our home and go full-time into the ministry, and we did that very thing. Now, had I never lost that job, I never would have gone into the ministry because I took a 60% pay cut going from what I had at the window company as an installation manager to now working for a very small church that was in transition as a temporary kind of role. But it was that pivot point. It was that loss of a job that spurred me on, that caused me to look, that caused me to see this and then talk to this church. And before I knew it, within about a year, we were selling our home and then we were moving. And then the Lord continued to open more doors and more doors and more doors. Now, I can tell you, on my drive home after losing my job, I was convinced. I'm going to get there, and the bank's going to take the house, and you know we're going to have to sell the kids, and we're going to do all this stuff because there's just no way that we're going to be able to afford anything. You know, and so I don't know how it's going to happen. My wife doesn't make enough. We had a dual income. We were based on a dual income. You know, social services is coming, and the dog's going to get taken away, and the truck's going to get sold, and everything's repossessed, and we're going to be on the corner with like a tin cup. And in my mind, in about 15 seconds, that's where I had our life. And yet I got home, I gave it to the Lord. I can't do anything about it. And he opened the door, and he used that as an opportunity to move us forward. And now I look back on that, and I can see how every one of those things was necessary in order for us to go the direction God was calling us. But I'll tell you, in the moment, it seemed impossible. It seemed hopeless. It seemed like it couldn't get any worse. We didn't have any savings. I didn't have a retirement. I wasn't ready for this. Financially, we weren't that stable. And yet it was that very event that God used, and he turned into an opportunity of hope. And so here it's just interesting that in Hosea, God says that Israel will be given the Valley Achor, and he renames it the Door of Hope. God will turn your trials into a triumph. He will turn victims into victors. He will turn weakness into strength. He will turn death into life. And so here, it says, then the border went up toward Debir from the valley of Achor. Go down to verse 8. And the border went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom. The son of Hinnom is on the east side of the Jerusalem River, or on the east side of Jerusalem, I'm sorry, in a valley that is also known by another name. It's the Valley of Kidron. And you might have heard of the Valley of Kidron. It meets right in that area, an area called the Valley of Gehenna. And Gehenna is the word in the Bible that's used to mean hell very often. And the reason it's called that is because in Jerusalem, you know, long before they had waste management and all the trash companies, people had to deal with their own garbage. And so there was this valley right there kind of on the side of Jerusalem, a slope that would just go kind of downward. And they would throw all of their trash over the wall down into this valley to the bottom where it was burning constantly. They lit it on fire. It was an ongoing incinerator. And so this thing never stopped. It was always there. The smell was horrible. And so it was called Gehenna, or a place of burning, and later it's used as an illustration of hell. And so here it talks about that very place. The border went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom to the southern slope of the Jebusite city, which is Jerusalem. Hard to imagine, but Jerusalem doesn't start with Israel. Israel will have to conquer Jerusalem that they're given by the Lord, but it's originally named the slope of the Jebusite city. And the border went up to the top of the mountain that lies there before the valley of Hinnom, westward, which is at the end of the valley of Rephaim, northward. And then it goes on to talk more and more and more about the borders there. But if you go forward to verse 12, it says, the west border was the coastline of the Great Sea. That is the Mediterranean Sea. You look on a map, remember, to the due west is Galilee. And then below Galilee is the Dead Sea. If you go west of there, you go into the Mediterranean Sea. And so they're in this place, and it says, this is the boundary of the children of Judah all around according to their families. So they have a wonderful plot of land. To one side is the Great Sea, the Mediterranean. To the other side is Galilee, the river, and then there is, or the Jordan, and then there is the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea below that. And so on either side, they're flanked by water barriers. Nothing stops an ancient army quite like water. In fact, to this very day, one of the reasons most historians say that America was able to rise to become the superpower that we are is because we have oceans on either side, really on like 2.5 sides of the nation, right? We have the Atlantic, we have the Pacific, and then south of the southern states, there's the Gulf of Mexico. We share only 2 international boundaries. I mean, honestly, is Mexico to the south, Canada to the north. We're friendly with both of them. We're not really worried about their tanks coming over the border, which means whenever there's a war, we're bombing other cities on other continents and other places. Our cities don't get bombed. Our land doesn't get pillaged. We don't have to worry about any of those things. And so we're kind of free to build and to recruit and to train and to arm and to do all the things. Our economy thrives even during World War II, as Germany was getting bombed and Japan and Italy and Great Britain and Russia and all these other places. The United States was largely unscathed. And so that has allowed us to rise to a very prominent position on the world stage because we don't have those setbacks from war the way other nations have. Well, as we see here, that's going to be the same story for the people of Judah. They're going to have water on both sides, borders to the north and the south, but again, surrounded by friendly tribes. And so it goes on to say, now we're going to Caleb. We were talking about the land of Judah. Remember, Judah got the most, but now we're at Caleb. And you remember, Caleb wanted to charge up the mountain. He wants to charge and fight and take the mountain of Hebron, and he wants to get all of his land. And so here's Caleb. Now Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. Now remember, again, from last week, very important to just keep this in mind. It tells us in chapter 14 that Jephunneh was a Kenizzite. Caleb is not an Israelite. At least not native. He wasn't born that way. He's a foreign national that immigrated to the nation. He went through the process of becoming a legal citizen of Israel, and he's then promoted up through the ranks. He becomes the leader of the nation here and certainly the leader of this group. And to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he gave a share among the children of Judah according to the commandment of the Lord to Joshua. Namely, it says, Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. The word Arba means village of four, and it's actually a Hebrew word that means four. Here it is, Kirjath Arba, village of four is what that translates to, but it was essentially named that because in there were giants in the area, so the village of four giants, basically. And most historians, most scholars will tell you that when Joshua and Caleb first came in with the other 10 spies to scout out the area, this is where they came to, where they saw the giants. And they went back with a report that said, there's no way that we can do it. because they're too big, they're too formidable. In fact, going back to give the report, they had cut down from Hebron this bunch of grapes, and the grapes were so big that they had to be stretched between a pole where two soldiers would carry it on their shoulders. And so they go back to Israel and say, look at what we're up against. This is nothing like we've ever seen before. And so they're back again, and he's about ready to attack, or he has attacked. And now he's going to be given this village of four, the name of the four giants in the area. It's also named that because there are four giants of faith in the area. In fact, four very prominent people of biblical history are buried there. It is the burial place, allegedly, of Adam, although no one can really verify that. But it is said that Adam is buried there, that Isaac is buried there, that Jacob is buried there, and that still to this day, also Abraham is buried there. You can actually go there. If you ever go on a tour of Israel and you go to this area, it'll be listed, it's labeled. Whether the remains are actually there, I don't believe they are, or they haven't been found. But nonetheless, history has shown and tradition says that this is the burial ground of these four giants of the faith, which was Adam, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so it's named for the village of four. For the giants that are there, the giants of faith, the giants also in the land, which is Hebron. Arba was the father of Anak. Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak from there, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. Then he went up from there to the inhabitants of Debir. Formerly the name of Debir was Kirjath Sefer. Anak is Anakim. In fact, back in chapter 14, verse 12, it even mentions it, and it says there that, now therefore give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke that day, for you heard in that day how the Anakim were there. And so Anak is one of the Anakim that we read about. And so this is the battle that Caleb wanted 45 years ago. This is the thing that he's been waiting for. He saw that mountain and he thought, ah, that one's mine. That's the mountain that God has promised me. Come on, guys, we can go get it. Him and Joshua and the other 10 were there. And he said, look, we can take this. God has given it to us. Well, we know the story. The other 10 doubted, so they didn't get to do it. So for 45 years, Caleb has been waiting for this battle. He's been waiting as Israel was wandering through the wilderness. He waited as they conquered the southern portion of Canaan. He's waited until now they've conquered the northern portion of Canaan. He's 85 years old now, and this is the battle that he's been wanting since chapter 14. This is the one where he said, let me go and get that thing that God said was mine. And I love that about Caleb. I've said it over and over. But he's a guy that just, they forgot to put in the quit when they made Caleb. He's the one that no matter what it is, he's looking for the next challenge. I can relate to that. This is a guy after my own heart. This is a guy who sees a challenge as an opportunity. He sees a fight and runs into the fray, not away from it. He's not ever content with the status quo. He wants to build, he wants to conquer, he wants to do the next thing. He doesn't sit still very long. He gets bored with the routine and the humdrum of life. This is a guy that, you know, he's fixed everything around the house and he can only mow the yard so many times, and playing fetch with the dog isn't all that fun, and he doesn't want to sit on his porch all day long. He's got to a point where he says, Lord, there's got to be more to life than just this. I'm not ready to be retired yet. There's got to be something I can do. Oh, there's a mountain I can fight. Now, I don't know about you, but at 85, I don't think I'm going to be looking to invade a mountain. But that's exactly what Caleb wants to do. For 45 years, he's been thinking about this. I think many of us have had things in our mind, maybe from our youth, that we never quite got to do. I know one person who climbed Mount Everest. And I remember thinking, wow, I don't want to do that. That sounds horrible. I mean, I know a lot of people do. It's an adventure of a lifetime. I'm sure, but definitely doesn't ring my bell. I'm not the climb Mount Everest type of person. I definitely love a challenge, but that doesn't sound like one. However, this person wanted to do it, and they couldn't do it when they originally wanted to. They had to wait. And so they trained and they practiced. They had a setback medically. They came back a little bit stronger. Finally, after years of waiting, they got their chance to go do Mount Everest, and they were able to do it. It was such a rewarding thing to finally do the thing that they had always wanted. And I'm sure there are things that are in your life. I know I have things in my life where it's like, Lord, if you ever gave me the opportunity to do that, I've always wanted to do that. And, you know, the clock is ticking, and I'm not sure how much time I have left. Just when I start thinking I might be beyond the point that I can do that anymore, or maybe you're starting to think that, you read this and you go, Caleb's 85 years old and he's going to go declare war on a mountain. And not only that, but this is a mountain of giants. This was the mountain that scared the other 10 spies. This is the mountain that had the fortifications that laid fear into the hearts of all the Israelites that led them to wander the wilderness for 40 years. And so finally, Caleb is going to get to go to war against his mountain. And I just love that about the story. So he went up from there to the inhabitants of Debir. Formerly, the name of Debir was Kirjath Sefer. That doesn't really mean anything for us, but it's here. And Caleb said, he who attacks Kirjath or Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give Akshah, my daughter, as wife. So Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, took it. And he gave him Akshah, his daughter, as wife. If you ever want to name kids, don't look to the Bible. I'm just saying. No one will ever get the names right. But he gave him Akshah, his daughter, as wife. Now it was so, when she came to him, that she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. So she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, what do you wish? And she answered, give me a blessing. Since you've given me the land in the south, give me also springs of water. So he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. So it appears Caleb here knows he's got a fight ahead of him. Maybe a little bit of reality setting in. Maybe he realizes 85 ain't 20. And there comes a point you might need some help. And so he enlists the help of some others. And he says, look, I'm going to let you go actually fight this battle. I'll manage it. You know, I'm going to lead from the rear kind of thing. We're going to go do this. We're taking on this challenge. But I need some younger backs to actually go up Everest. And so he puts out the offer. Whoever does this can have my daughter as a bride. Well, Othniel does it. He goes and takes on the challenge. He gets the wife. And it's interesting because in Judges chapter 3, we read about him again. And it tells us that Othniel was a very righteous man and that the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. And so this is a guy who will serve later as the first judge of Israel. He's a guy that God is going to call into the ministry. I mean, if you're looking for a husband for your daughter, Othniel is not going to be the worst guy you can find for sure. He's a guy that's brave. He's tenacious, he's bold, he's not afraid of a challenge, he loves the Lord, the Spirit of God is upon him, he's going to serve in the ministry as a national leader, and so he certainly is a great guy. Not only will he serve in the ministry as a judge, which isn't a judge in the criminal justice sense, but you know in the Bible the judges were individuals that the Lord rose up to go judge in very violent manner, usually, the oppressing nations against Israel. Well, Othniel will be the first one. He's going to deliver them from the Mesopotamian king. And so he's going to go and do a great thing for his nation. He's going to serve the Lord faithfully and bravely. And so this is the guy that comes into the family. But notice even after that, notice the request, the daughter, Akshah, she says, look, you gave me this field, that's great, but look, I need some water. It's hard to live in the desert without water. We lived in Albuquerque for many years, and I'll tell you, water is so important. You can drink gallons of water and still be thirsty. I remember it was never enough. And so they need water. She gets a husband. Everything's going well. And so finally, Caleb has his mountain, and Caleb's happy. So now we have the cities of Judah. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Judah, according to their families. And so it talks about it all the way down. If you skip ahead to verse 32, it says, all the cities are 29 with their villages. Now, here's the thing. And some have done this, and they've said, you see, the Bible made a mistake. Not so fast. If you count all these cities up, if you actually go through and say, okay, here's one city and another, you're actually going to get not 29 cities, but this is actually going to be 36. And so, no, it's not a mathematical error. No, they didn't have math back then different than we have math now. But what happens is later on, and actually it's in chapter 18, that seven of these cities are going to be given to Simeon by Judah as a gift. And so they will in total have 29 of these, but right now, if you counted them up, you will read 36. It says in verse 33, in the lowland, and the lowland is, just understand all of these cities. Again, we don't need to go through all of them, but the region it's describing is a prized region of the area. It's a key area in Israel. It's filled with cities. It's one of the most heavily populated areas. I mean, the lowland, just to compare it to something, would be like if you drove through Oley, and you go, wow, it's just so beautiful out here. If you go out to Lancaster and you just look at all the farmland and all the lush greenery. I read somewhere that Lancaster has some of the most fertile farmland in the entire world. And so just imagine Lancaster, imagine Oley, imagine kind of those areas, and then put that in the Middle East and you're now dealing with the lowland. It was the most fertile area, just about everything grew there. Had great soil, a lot of farmland. And one of the reasons was it was an area that was below sea level. And so from time to time it would flood. It got a lot of water, a lot of irrigation. And because it was below sea level and because it was right in between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, below the basin of sea level, there was just a lot of sediment that went into it. And still to this very day, if you look at Israel, they have some of the most lush farmland of the entire world. Now, nowadays they do that through artificial irrigation. They desalinize a lot of the water. But it just goes to show that what is there really is a land flowing with milk and honey. When God said, look, you can have this land, we picture it as a desert. But back then, it was lush. There was a lot of green. There was certainly desert, but there was a lot of great farmland, a lot of places that you could plant and have vineyards and olive groves and all kinds of things. And so they were given the lowland, and it gives, again, the names of all the cities. And so in verse 61, it says, in the wilderness, Beth Arabah, Midin, Sekakah, Nibshan, the city of salt, and En-Gedi, six cities with their villages. The city of salt literally being the city of Qumran in the New Testament. It's where the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually discovered right there. So it's got a lot of historical significance. And we're skipping over a whole lot because, again, most of these places don't exist anymore. I'm just trying to point out some of the highlights. As for the Jebusites, it says, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah, could not drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this day. If you add up all of the conquest of Israel, you're going to find that they take 122 cities. That's a lot. I mean, think about an ancient army marching, taking water, taking food, taking animals, casualties and medics and all the equipment and all the support that you need to move an army, the carts and the wagons. You know, right now, whenever the U.S. military goes into a battle zone, roughly 85% of all the stuff that goes to war actually isn't there for the fighting. It's there for the support. It's the tents, it's the logistics, the trucks, it's the water tanks, it's the hospitals, it's all the stores and supplies and the cafeterias and everything else they're going to need in order to go and support the fighting soldiers. Only about 15% or so of all the assets deployed to a battle zone actually go into war. And so we certainly have a more complex scenario than they did back then. But just understand, to take 122 cities, you still have to feed 40,000 soldiers, which is what Israel had. You still have to move them. If that's 40,000, that's 120,000 meals a day. I mean, you start to think about the magnitude of what you have to move to go and take 122 cities. But it's interesting, out of 122 cities, the one they couldn't take was Jerusalem. It's funny, because Jerusalem will become the capital. Jerusalem is where Jesus will ride the donkey into. Jerusalem is where he'll be crucified. Jerusalem is where the temple will be built. Jerusalem is where the new heaven and the new earth will focus in on. There will be the new heaven, the new earth, the new Jerusalem. It seems like it becomes the epicenter of spirituality in the world. And yet Israel couldn't take it. In fact, they're not going to take Jerusalem until David conquers it later in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And so for a long time, for hundreds of years, Jerusalem will be unbreachable. Israel will not own it. I think it's kind of a great warning for us to just read that very fact. Israel had conquered 122 cities. They, practically speaking, owned the entire territory. The 12 tribes had their land. They got to where they were happy. They were comfortable. They come to the last city of Jerusalem. God said this was theirs. But interestingly, they don't take it. Why? I think, honestly, they didn't want to. I think they got to a point where they said, Lord, this is good enough. We don't need that. We don't need to go and fight again. We have enough. We're going to settle with what we have. That's going to be too much for us to go and sacrifice, to go and launch a new campaign again. And so I think Israel gets to a point where they just stop slightly short of the fullness of the blessing God has in their life. And I think a lot of people make that mistake as well. I love that it ends the chapter on this note, because we've just read, and there are 63 verses in this chapter. Now, we didn't read them all, but we read about 122 cities that Israel took. 122 times they went and they followed the Lord and they took possession of what God had told them to, and they were faithful and obedient, but they come to the final one and they stop, and yet it is in that last city that the greatest blessing the world has ever seen will happen. And I think it's a great analogy of the way many Christians live their life. And that is, we go through the easy stuff. We grab the low-hanging fruit. You know, all these cities that we just spend all this monotonous time kind of skipping over and trying to pronounce and stumbling through. We get to where we say, Lord, look, you know, I know your plan was for me to do all of this, but look, this is good enough. I don't need to go and struggle again. I don't need another battle. I'm 85. I don't need that mountain. I'm good with it. I know that your blessing for me is fulfilled when I just go that last mile. But for many Christians, they get 99% of the way there. And right when they're at the precipice of the greatness that God has designed for them to have, they give up and stop. Just short of the blessing. They get to where they just need to cross the line. Just finish the job. Finish it well. I love what Paul said at the end of his life. He said, my life is being poured out as a drink offering. He said of his own life that he has run the race. He's fought the fight. And he's ready for the reward that was promised to him. And I think Paul made an intentional effort to live his life to the fullness. He didn't want to go almost all the way and call it a day. And I think for a lot of believers, they get almost all the way there. They get really close to God's blessing in their life, and then they pull back. It costs just a little bit too much. It gets a little too uncomfortable. It's a little too real. Yeah, it was really easy when it was just going to church on Sunday. It was really easy when it meant reading my Bible a couple minutes a day. It was a little bit harder when they asked me to start volunteering, but I could do that. It was a little bit harder when I started giving, but you know, I just gave the change out of my pocket. And now the Lord's put these convictions on my life, and you know, now it's starting to really cost something. Now he's calling me to sell my home and go to a new land. Like he called Abraham, go to a land that I'll show you. And then it got even harder for Abraham. Give me back the son that I've given you. And yet it says in Hebrews 11 that Abraham was justified because of that. And so for a lot of us, we get to that point where it just starts to hurt too much. It costs too much. It's too hard. It's too big of a step. Lord, I'm not ready for that. I mean, I can do all this other stuff you've asked me, but that, you know, if that's what it's going to take to get Jerusalem, I don't need it. I'm okay. Really, I'm okay with where I am. I don't want to give that thing up. I'm too attached to it. It's too much a part of my life. I don't want to move in that direction. It's going to be too costly. It might be real uncomfortable. You know, I love where I live. I love my job. I love my friends. And as long as I can be a Christian and have these things, then I'm on board. But now, Lord, you're calling me to give up the last of the things that define who I am. And I don't need Jerusalem. 122 cities, that's fine. I'm good with that. Just leave me alone. Let me be in that. It's unfortunate because Israel comes to Jerusalem. And it says they could not drive them out. But the Jebusites, in verse 63, dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem to this very day. And even to this very day in the news, Israel is fighting in Jerusalem. Imagine how it would have been had they said, no, we are finishing this march. We're going to conquer Jerusalem just like God told us. I wonder how the headlines would read these days if Israel had actually finished the job that God had called them to do. And so it says that the Jebusites and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah, could not drive them out. I don't think their heart was in it. I think they'd been through enough in their mind. I think this was too expensive. I think it was too hard. It was the hardest battle was saved for last. And so they didn't drive them out. They said, no, we'll settle down. We'll leave it as is. Nobody else needs to go and risk anything. And so they live with them to this very day. I wonder how much of our lives might be different if when we come to the Jerusalems of life, we press forward. We say, Lord, this is where my flesh wants to stop, and so I know this is where I need to keep going. I know, Lord, this is where it gets the hardest, and so this is where I want to push through the most. When I wake up, I usually go out to the gym, and I've gotten into kind of a habit of it, and I love it. I go at an hour. There's like no one there. It's great. You walk into a gym. There's nobody there. There's like a couple people, and they're all on a treadmill, and I'm thinking, all right, I got the whole gym to myself. And I get on a machine, or I get under the barbell, and you always get to a point where it's like, all right, now it hurts. It hurts. I want to stop right now. But you know that in exercise, it is at that point and beyond that the real growth happens. It is where we reach our perceived limit that growth begins. If all we ever do is what's easy, we're never going to enjoy the fullness of the blessing that God has for us. In the book of James, he says, count it all joy when you meet trials, because you know they're there to build you up. Paraphrasing, but that's the message. And so here, Israel did not do that. They do not to this very day have uncontested ownership over Jerusalem. And to this very day, there are enemies at their gates. And to this very day, there is unrealized blessing. And so it's my prayer for us that when we come to those final cities, those final battles, that we would press forward. You know, it's one thing to take all these cities we can't even pronounce. I mean, Yawn Fest, I know. But we come to the very end, and that's where it matters. Where we finish well, we finish the job, we drive out the last of the enemy, we purge the last of the sin, we commit to that last measure, and we grow in the Lord. Chapter 16 is very short, but we do not have time for it this evening, so hopefully next week we'll do chapter 16 and 17 as we continue this study in Joshua. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the evening. Lord, it's interesting how you have designed your word. Because we go through 62 verses of just cardboard, Lord. I mean, it's really not all that interesting. A lot of facts. It's not that exciting. It's not that invigorating. And then we come to the very end where we find that your people stop. And it's almost as if you designed it to kind of mimic their journey as they go from town to town to town to town, no real excitement. But when they come to the very end, when it mattered the most, when it was the most blessing, when it was the greatest reward, and at the same time, one of the hardest challenges, Lord, we find that they stop. Lord, it's tempting to stop. It's tempting to do the easy thing and to stop at the hard thing. It's tempting to just kind of move through mindlessly through the boredom of life. And then when we come to the real challenge to say, look, I don't think it's worth it. But Father, we know that on the other side of that is where the growth is the blessing. That's where the promise is. It's not on this side of the river. It's on that side of the river. And we need to cross it in faith. And it means sometimes that we need to step out in faith and be willing to give up and to surrender the very things that maybe we've become comfortable with. But we know, Lord, we cannot give them to a more trustworthy steward than you. When we give our lives to you, when we give our futures to you, our families, our finances, when we give our hopes and our dreams and all of our aspirations to you, Lord, we have given them to the best one we can. And so, Lord, I pray that as we surrender these things to you, as we come to these challenges and we realize that it's going to be very difficult moving forward, but we know because you told us in our hearts that on the other side of this is the greatness that you've promised. Father, I pray that we would have the courage to push beyond the barrier. I pray that we would keep going. I pray that we would not stop when the easy part runs out, but we would push on, surrendering to you, moving in faith, and claiming the very things that you have promised for us. Lord, would you be with us this week as we go into our lives, as we continue the work week and we finish it out? I pray we'd finish well. I pray as we come across these challenges that we would have the strength to carry on. Father, would you keep us safe as we travel and bring us back again as we gather together.